This is going to be a very painful, very, very painful 2 weeks. When you look and see at night the kind of death that's been caused by this invisible enemy, it's incredible.
That's President Trump this week talking about the coronavirus pandemic that he first called a hoax, despite warnings from scientific advisors. Just last week, he was still optimistic about opening up the economy right away.
I'd love to have the country opened up and just raring to go by Easter.
Now, the president has accepted projections that 100,000 to 200,000 Americans will die in a very short time.
A lot of people are positive and they hope for the best, because when this gets the wrong person, meaning a person that qualifies, generally speaking, under the list, it is ravaging. It is horrible.
He even told CNN's Jim Acosta he has prevented the death toll from being even worse.
Look, Jim, I think we've done a great job. We're going to see how it comes out. But when you look at minimal numbers of 120,000 people, when you look at it could have been 2.2 million people died and more if we did nothing.
It was on Tuesday that the president claimed his actions have reduced the death toll, and it's important to put that claim in context. Just one day before, I talked with David Sanger, national security correspondent for the New York Times. After months of downplaying the pandemic, Trump had finally said he'd declared war. And I asked Sanger how that was going.
Well, Warren, what he's done so far is try to have the rhetoric of a wartime presidency, but it's not clear to us that he has actually been willing to take the responsibility of a wartime leader.
At one point, Trump even said it himself.
No, I don't take responsibility at all, because we were given a set of circumstances and we were given rules, regulations, and specifications from a different time.
Here's more of my interview with David Sanger.
You know, the most critical way you can examine this is the buildup to make sure that the frontline combatants here, the doctors, the nurses, the hospitals, other medical care workers, had all of the ammunition that they needed for this war. And while you've heard a lot lately about efforts to get GM and Ford and others into producing ventilators, the most critical single thing for those who are in need of critical care, what's clearly missing from all of this were orders to get that production going in, say, late January or early February. And the reason that didn't happen was that the president was continuing to deny that this would come. He keeps saying things like, I stopped the flights coming from China. Well, actually, he stopped Chinese, but not Americans from coming in from China. So, of course, there was a path for it to make its way here. But what he didn't do until the past couple of weeks was actually rev up the government in the way it would needed to be revved up in order to get people the ammunition and the defensive material they required.
But once again, the president has denied responsibility.
This administration inherited a broken system, a system that was obsolete, a system that didn't work.
David Sanger, what do you say?
Well, it wasn't all dismantled, but certainly parts of it were broken. He's right about that. And that then raises the question, what was the action plan in the 3 years between the time he was inaugurated and the time that the virus began coming to American shores, which is almost 3 years to the day, to make sure that that system was no longer broken? And he doesn't have a whole lot to point to, because the stockpiles were not refilled in that time, even if you could legitimately say that Barack Obama let them go too low. The plan for responding was not reviewed. They were left with a game plan by the Obama administration. They didn't like it, but they didn't replace it with another. And I think the most damning part of this, Warren, was that they did run, to their credit, a full simulation of what a virus like this would look like if it was coming to the United States. It was called Crimson Contagion. We wrote about it about a week and a half ago. It was a full simulation run out of the Department of Health and Human Services. It built on simulations done in the Obama administration. And what did it predict for a similar, but not same kind of pandemic. It predicted 110 million infections, 7.7 million hospitalized patients, 580,000 American deaths. And when you sort of took that and you then moved it to the task of what we could handle, no one did that execution. And that Crimson Contagion was completed in August of last year.
And now the lack of sufficient equipment for doctors and nurses and hospitals has states in what New York's Governor Andrew Cuomo calls a mad bidding war.
So you have 50 states competing to buy the same item. We all wind up bidding up each other and competing against each other, where you now literally will have a company call you up and say, well, California just outbid you. It's like being on eBay with 50 other states bidding on a ventilator.
Here's the president's response to that.
We gave him a lot of ventilators. And you know what? He has a lot of ventilators. The problem is with some people, no matter what you give, it's never enough. It's never enough.
So, David Sanger, how did that happen?
Well, it happened because the president decided that while he was the commander in chief, he was going to let each one of the states scramble themselves to get the ventilators and other equipment. He told them as much in a cabinet meeting or a meeting that he led from the cabinet room by phone with the governors about a week ago. And what did that do? It meant that every state was putting in their orders with the same small number of ventilator manufacturers, the same small number of suppliers for masks. And naturally, as the demand soared, so did the price. So the first thing you'd do if you were taking over as commander in chief here is you would go try to assess what you were all going to need, what the needs were going to be, and then have the U.S. government try to allocate that to the places that were most in need. And instead, it was going to the highest bidder instead of to the cities that were the hotspots.
All right. So, David, how complex is this supply chain? It's my understanding that there are 700 to 1,500 components just in the ventilators. They're made in 12 different nations. There are just six or seven distributors in this country, but 600 or 700 district distribution nodes, as they call the hospitals and the others that need them.
Well, yes, we reported as we sort of dug into this on this supply chain, and not surprisingly, it's a very long chain. Remember that the ventilators have two big elements to them. One is the plastic tubing and so forth that you've seen when you see pictures of people going through these fairly difficult intubations. And that you can make with a 3D printer and produce fairly quickly. But the machines themselves have electric motors, sensors, and electronics, much of which comes from overseas suppliers. So even those who make the stuff in the United States, and there are not many of those, have a supply chain that runs way back out of the country. So you can invoke the Defense Production Act. I think it was a good thing that the White House has begun to talk about doing that. But that doesn't help you speed up a supply chain for a supplier who may be in China or in Europe or something like that. On top of which, even some of the American-based companies do their production of the ventilators outside the United States. There's some production in Ireland, there's some production in Switzerland, and of course, there's production in China.
There's a report, a recent report, that there has arrived, I think it was Sunday, a large shipment of ventilators from China. How did that come about? And what does it suggest about the way it's all being handled by the administration?
Well, it's good that, you know, the shipments are coming in from China. I mean, if you've built a supply system that was not built for crisis, but instead for steady demand of 10 or 20,000 ventilators a year, and it didn't really make a difference if they arrived this week or next month, then that system's fine. But, you know, we find ourselves now in this kind of crisis, sort of where we are in the debate over whether you want Huawei to be taking over your 5G communications networks, which is not thinking about how the network operates in normal times when having foreign suppliers and foreign owners are fine, but what happens when it happens in crisis and you need to be in charge of your own supply chain. And that's where this fell down. This was viewed not really as a national security issue, but much more as a healthcare issue. Same thing happened with masks. You know, 20 years ago, most masks were produced in the United States. Now, 80% of the production is in China and elsewhere, which is why you can't just turn the supply chain on and instantly have masks available.
Now, Mr. Trump has always claimed he's the first president to really understand business, but he has trouble with the medical supply chain. He says it's really complex, like building a car.
Well, certainly the supply chain issues seem to. The question we have not gotten answered from this White House is why the assessment of what the needs would be for production didn't happen back in late January and February. And in fact, the other day, the Surgeon General came out and scolded the reporters in the White House press room by saying that this is no time to be looking back. We should be looking only forward. Well, I can understand why we need to look forward. We've got an urgent crisis on our hands. But, you know, even in the middle of World War II, Congress ran an inquiry, a full commission on why Pearl Harbor happened. We ran a 9/11 commission to figure out why that happened. We ran a Challenger commission to figure out why that happened. And the reason you do that is that you can't be ready for the next crisis until you figured out what went wrong in this one. Now, a lot of people would say, let's just get past all of this, and then, you know, we can do that commission next year or the year after. Well, it's not clear you have that much time. Even before this particular virus might mutate, or before another one comes on the way.
Well, let me ask you this. Is it unfair to criticize the president for not seeing this coming sooner? His supporters are quoting a lot of various leaders, Mayor de Blasio, the health commissioner of New York City, even the New York Times, with a story in January, I believe, saying, don't panic and worry more about the flu. And Joe Biden said, what we really have to fear is fear mongering. So is it fair to put the blame on the president when everybody else was sort of downplaying it in January?
Well, there's a lot of it to be shared around. It's just the president made a sort of buck stops here. When you sit in command, you've got the responsibility. But I think you can certainly argue that Mayor de Blasio was very slow on closing the schools and so forth and resistant to it, maybe for some good reasons, but he was certainly slow. I think that our own coverage of this is not above reproach because at the time the president was cutting off some, not all of the flights from China. I think that there wasn't a serious enough look at the modeling of how this would make it here anyway. Certainly there's a lot of blame to go around. But, you know, if the president's ready to go take credit for a good performing economy or a good performing healthcare system, then he's also got to be willing to go take the responsibility when that market drops or when that healthcare system doesn't perform. And here, I think there's a reason to believe, just from listening to the president, that he was so focused on the fear that could undercut the markets before the election time that he insufficiently focused on the cause of the fear, which was the virus itself, and didn't understand its power.
So you don't buy the idea that this is the mainstream media spinning the situation in order to damage the president's chances for re-election?
It was the president who said we had 15 cases going to zero and that this is under control. That was just about a month ago, a little more. And it's the president who over the weekend said, you know, I think we may get away with 100,000 deaths if we're lucky, and it's under control.
What about his saying we can't let the cure be worse than the problem? Has he gotten beyond that?
Well, you know, we didn't think so until Sunday afternoon when he came out in the Rose Garden and suddenly had not only moved away from the country will reopen in at Easter, but that April 30th was the new date. And if you listen to him carefully, June 1st was the real date. I think he has finally been persuaded, probably by the projections that upwards of 2.2 million Americans could die if the stay-at-home provisions, the work-from-home provisions, if the social distancing didn't remain in place. I think he's finally come around to understanding that in virus economics, You have to get rid of the virus first before you can go deal with the economy.
Do you think there's any possibility that he'll buy into this idea that we've got to the point where we simply have to let the virus spread and develop herd immunity? In other words, go back to business as usual, let things take their course. People have advised that from time to time. Is the president, do you think, listening to any of that?
You know, it's hard to tell. I mean, in an ideal world, you'd keep everybody isolated until you had a way of immunizing 80% of the population, and then the virus would die out from itself. But if you believe you're on a timeline for having a vaccine here of 12 to 18 months, you obviously can't keep the economy shuttered and people out of work for anything close to that period of time. So the president's right. There's going to have to be a compromise. And that compromise is understanding that this is going to come in waves. And can you put some people back to work? What do you do if you get a second wave? Do you go back to the back-to-home orders or not? And these are the really hard issues we're going to have to sort out now. And of course, you're doing it in the midst of an election, which doesn't make it any easier.
So just to put this in context, a final question. You are the national security correspondent for the New York Times. To what extent are we talking about national security?
100%. I mean, you're discussing here something that can weaken the United States diplomatically, economically, and biologically. What more could be a national security issue? And, you know, that's not a new thought. Maybe it's a new thought to some in this administration. But Warren, you know, on your radio show, we first talked when I wrote a book called The Inheritance about what George W. Bush was leaving other than Iraq to Barack Obama. And you'll remember it had a big chapter at the end about biohazards to American national security. At the time, we were still thinking of them more in the terms of bioweapons than in the terms of pandemics. But over the past 10 years, it's become increasingly clear that pandemics can cause as much havoc as a bioweapon can. And so it's fully a national security issue, and it always has been. Whether it's always been thought of as one, that's another question.
Yeah, that's a rumor we all remember all too well. You've been on these issues for a long, long time as national security correspondent for the New York Times. Let me remind our listeners, the latest book, The Perfect Weapon, War, Sabotage, and Fear in the Cyber Age. Now we're looking at something very different from that, but in many ways, disturbingly similar. David Sanger, thanks so much.
Thank you, Warren. Great to talk to you.
And once again, we talked to David Sanger on Monday, and that was the day before the president finally accepted the scientific projections about the death toll from the coronavirus pandemic. At Tuesday's briefing, the following day, he was asked about a claim by Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell that his attention had been diverted earlier by the impeachment trial.
I don't think I would have done any better had I not been impeached. Okay. And I think that's a great tribute to something. Maybe it's a tribute to me, but I don't think I would have acted any differently, or I don't think I would have acted any faster.
Trump now says he agrees with Dr. Anthony Fauci. Of course, he's the scientist who famously advocates an extension of federal guidelines for social distancing.
But the reason why we feel so strongly about the necessity of the additional 30 days is that now is the time, whenever you're having an effect, not to take your foot off the accelerator and on the brake, but to just press it down on the accelerator. And that's what I hope and I know that we can do over the next 30 days.
So why didn't the president warn the nation sooner?
This is really easy to be negative about, but I want to give people hope too. You know, I'm a cheerleader for the country. We're going through the worst thing that the country's probably ever seen.
Okay, so the president has finally accepted the reality of the coronavirus pandemic, which might kill between 1 and 200,000 Americans just in the next few weeks. What does that awful prospect and the Trump administration's delayed reaction tell us about the state of the nation's healthcare system? Jonathan Cohn is a senior national correspondent for the HuffPost. He's also author of a book called Sick: The Untold Story of America's Health Crisis and the People Who Pay the Price. Welcome to The Point.
Thanks for having me on the show.
As we heard from David Sanger a little bit earlier, the president did not set up a national response of some kind. He delegated authority to the governors.
Well, the governors are always on the front lines, right? I mean, if you're a governor, you are directly responsible for the people in your state. You're the ones who the hospitals are coming to. You're the one who is ones who are going to set health policy, you know, so in terms of public health measures like, you know, quarantines and stay-at-home orders, that's all done at the state level because of the way our country is organized. So that falls on the governor. So they've been dealing with this. They have to deal with this. You know, and for the first few weeks of this crisis, really for the first few months, they were more or less on their own because you'll remember the president was out there saying, this is no big deal. We have this under control. 15 people have it. Pretty soon it's going to be down to zero. And by that point, if you listened, you had governors saying, wait a minute, I don't think that's right. We can see what's coming. They had public health people saying, this is coming to your state. You need to deal with it. What we have seen since then is the federal government has been, you know, ramping up its support, and we can talk about when and why the Trump administration has changed its approach. But, you know, it was very late in the process. It was not until March that the president finally declared a national emergency, activating a full federal response. And even at beyond that point, has very much been saying to the governors, look, you deal with this. You know, we'll back you up. Come to us if you need something, which is really not the way a response to a crisis like this is supposed to work. The federal government is supposed to be taking charge of the big picture, of organizing, of setting priorities so that the governors have the tools to do for their states what they need. And right now they don't have the tools.
You, as you just indicated, are in Michigan, and the president referred not to the governor of Michigan by name, but in this way.
And I say, Mike, don't call the governor of Washington. You're wasting your time with him. Don't call the woman in Michigan.
Jonathan, tell us, who's the president talking about, and where does she stand?
Well, that woman in Michigan is Gretchen Whitmer, who is the governor of Michigan. And the first most obvious thing is, I don't think it's a coincidence that she's a woman and he referred to her as a woman. You'll notice you don't hear him referring to the governor of Washington, who he also has criticized. He doesn't refer to the governor of Washington as that man in Washington, but it's always that woman in Michigan. So, you know, obviously there's a gender issue there, which if you followed the history of Donald Trump, is not surprising. But putting that aside, you know, Whitmer is among the governors who has been was very vocally calling for the federal government to step up. She was critical of the federal response, said, look, they're slow. We need help. We need supplies. We need masks. We need ventilators. We don't feel like the federal government is providing us with what we need. Now, she was not the only governor to do that. Several others did as well. Trump did not take kindly to that. And, you know, he basically was saying, you know, we expect, you know, he made statements like, this is a two-way street, and we expect appreciation from the governors. And he certainly implied that if governors weren't being nicer to him, their states might not get all the supplies they needed, or they might not get the attention they need. Now, I don't know if that's actually happened or not. It's hard to tell. But that was certainly the message that came through in his statements.
You're in Michigan, but you are from Florida. What about the governor there?
Yeah, so there's a fairly remarkable contrast between the way Trump has treated Whitmer and Governor DeSantis in Florida. He's been very friendly towards Governor DeSantis, praised him. Oh, he's a great governor. He's doing great things for the people of Florida in this crisis. Well, meanwhile, down in Florida, actually, public health officials are practically out of their minds over the fact that Governor DeSantis, number one, didn't close the beaches on spring break. And then even now has not ordered a sort of full statewide stay-at-home order, even though at this point it's got more cases than, say, Whitmer did when she ordered a similar guidance for the state of Michigan. And Florida, you know, is already looks like it's going to be an epicenter. We know there's community spread of the disease there. We know that it has a large elderly population, a lot of people living in assisted living and nursing homes, which are just so prone to this kind of infection. DeSantis has basically said, well, you know, look, we want to be careful for why I said, you know, the cost of shutting down business is serious. We want to think about that. And look, there are parts of the state that really don't seem to have a lot of cases. Well, again, as every public health expert has said, as we were just discussing earlier, nobody really knows in many parts of the state how many cases there are because we haven't done enough testing. And very clearly, it's going to spread to those places, even if it's not quite there now. And remember, keep in mind, this disease has a reasonably long incubation period so that, you know, it will be, there's going to be a lag between when people contract it and start spreading it and that people start showing up at the hospitals. So DeSantis is basically defying the advice of public health experts. Up in Michigan, you have Whitmer listening to the public health experts, and yet it is Whitmer, not DeSantis, who Trump keeps insulting.
Now, let me remind our listeners, before all this came down, you wrote a book called Sick, The Untold Story of America's Health Crisis and the People Who Pay the Price. So what's happening now that illustrates the point you were trying to make?
Yeah, well, you know, so it's funny, that book came out in 2007 and was very much a book about all the people in America who can't afford their health care because they don't have insurance or their insurance, you know, leaves them exposed to such high bills for one reason or another, they can't afford it. And that came out in 2007 as we were starting a very large national debate about health care reform. And of course, the end of that debate was the passage of the Affordable Care Act. And, you know, we just celebrated the 10-year anniversary of that law. You know, on the one hand, you look around and we still have, you know, tens of millions of people who don't have insurance or they have high out-of-pocket costs. And so very much in the same position of the people I wrote about in that book. And you can look at that and say, wow, we still have a really big problem. At the same time, you can look at it and say the problem would be much, much worse if not for the Affordable Care Act. I mean, you would have 20 million more people without health insurance. You'd have more people with pre-existing conditions who couldn't get coverage. So, I mean, you know, one takeaway is that we moved in the right direction in terms of helping people to get coverage and sort of establishing the basic principles of universal health care. But we're not there yet. And, you know, that's sort of the next phase of the debate is how do we get there? And of course, that is something that's being talked about in politics. It's been a very big issue in the Democratic primaries, perhaps will be a big issue in the general election, in part because while the Democrats are talking about how do we get to universal health care, what's the next step? You know, how do we continue this journey that, you know, that started with Medicare in the 60s and now the Affordable Care Act? But the Republican view is to move to roll this all back. And in fact, right now, the Trump administration is in court asking the federal courts to invalidate the entire Affordable Care Act, which would put us back to where we were in 2008. So you'd have 20 million people losing their health insurance. And they actually asked President Trump about this a couple of days ago at a press conference saying, geez, we're in the middle of this pandemic. The last thing we want is to be talking about taking health insurance away from people. Do you still support that lawsuit? And he said he did.
Final question. He has also said, has the vice president, that everybody in the United States can get tested for COVID-19 if they have to, and that the tests will be free. Is that true?
Yes and no. I mean, in theory, the insurers have all said they are making it free, and there have been various efforts in legislation to make it free. You know, this is one of those where the distance between theory and practice is fairly significant. And so we need to actually make sure no one is charging for these. I think we're about to get into a situation very soon where everyone is going to discover that when you have a patchwork insurance system like we do, where, you know, this group of people is getting insurance from Medicare, these people are getting it from Medicaid, these people are getting it from private insurance through an employer, and these people are buying private insurance on their own. And then there are these people who don't have insurance. And trying to cover any medical expense, whether it's a coronavirus test or treatment, for all of these people actually is difficult because you have to deal with so many different payers. I would not be surprised if at the end of this debate in the next few weeks, basically the federal government just comes and says, look, we're going to create a fund to cover coronavirus testing and treatment. And basically, if you have insurance that covers it or public, great. Otherwise, just the hospitals are just, and the doctors will just bill the federal government out of this fund and we'll take care of it. That will be expensive. I don't know if that'll be a fortune. I mean, in the grand scheme of things, we just pushed $2.5 trillion out the door to help the economy, and we're probably going to have to do it again, maybe an even bigger amount. So in that scale, this isn't that big an expense. But, you know, I do think then people are going to start to ask, well, geez, you know, if it makes sense for the government to pick up these expenses for coronavirus, well, why not in normal times for someone who has diabetes or cancer or heart disease? And, you know, people asking that question will be asking a very good question.
Okay. And of course, as we, as you indicated, Congress is in fact working apparently on the next aid package. We don't know yet what's going to come out of that. Thank you so much for bringing us up to date and also providing the context that I think people really need to understand what's going on. Jonathan Cohn, national correspondent for the HuffPost. Many thanks.
Thanks for having me on the show.
We'll take a brief break and then we'll get right back with To the Point.
Don't panic, we've got this.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. We've heard from Jonathan Cohn about what the pandemic is teaching us about America's health system. We heard earlier from David Sanger that it endangers our nation's security. But it's much more than that. Laurie Garrett is with us, Pulitzer Prize-winning science writer, former senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. In 2014, she wrote a book called Ebola about that epidemic. In 1994, she wrote a book called The Coming Plague. Laurie, thanks for being with us as always.
Thank you. Good to talk to you, Warren.
Now, before we began recording, you told me this. You're at the epicenter of the epicenter of the epicenter. What do you mean by that?
Well, right now, the epicenter for the world is the United States. The epicenter of the United States is New York State. The epicenter of New York State is New York City. And the epicenter of New York City is Brooklyn, Queens. And I'm in Brooklyn.
So there you are. How does it look to you from that vantage point, given all the time that you have spent studying the impact of a plague? And we really have a plague, it seems to me, with the coronavirus.
I've been in so many epidemics. I've tried to count. It's well over 30. But this feels very, very different. This is more like a combination of what it felt like to be in New York on 9/11. Only it's every single day, not just one day. And what it felt like to be in New York during and after Hurricane Sandy, but it's not just 2 days, it's on and on and on, and you see no end in sight. And the sound of sirens is a constant. Sometimes there are so many, they kind of come in a big concentration all at once. And you know that every one of them is an ambulance taking somebody to a hospital. And the city is very deserted. Everybody's hunkered down. Today, it's a ugly, drab, dreary, wet day. So there's really no problem enforcing the stay-at-home orders. We now have actual orders, and you can be fined up to $500 if you go outside without a good reason. As of today. But when the sun comes out and people have been feeling cabin fever, unfortunately, quite a lot of people go outside as soon as the sun comes out and start jogging and rolling the baby stroller and walking the dogs. And the couple of times that I've gone out when there were big crowds, it's quite nerve-wracking. I end up running right back to my apartment.
So there you are in the epicenter of the epicenter of the epicenter of the epicenter, which is currently the United States. But you've been to and been through epidemics in other parts of the world. How much longer is the U.S. going to be the epicenter, do you think? And where is it likely to be next?
Well, I think we will definitely exceed the levels seen anywhere else in the world for quite some time. Certainly well into June. And I think in the summer, the epidemic is going to shift its focus to the Southern Hemisphere because it will be their winter. And we'll see some really serious impacts in places like Brazil, South Africa, Nigeria, Indonesia, and so on. And then, of course, sort of straddling in between the hemispheres, we have India. And I think India is the wild card in this entire pandemic.
What do you mean by that? And what are the consequences?
India has never had a healthcare system that could possibly extend even rudimentary healthcare to the majority of its population. It's always the case that there's a severe caste system associated with everything, including access to health. And since the central government absolved itself of a lot of responsibility over health many years ago, it's all up to the states. And of course, the relative wealth of the states is extremely variable, so that there are some states that really are not capable of providing even primary health care to their population. And then you add on top of it, I mean, the minute Modi issued the order of stay at home and told the population to stop moving around, everybody got out and started walking home to their home villages. If mass transit was shut down, if the trains were shut down, they just walked. So actually, since that order was put out, we've seen, a terrible spread of people and likely of the virus. And I should, when I say that, I want to be very clear that well before President Trump started talking about quarantining off New York City from the rest of the United States, many New Yorkers left the city, most commonly to go to nearby vacation houses, such as beach houses, or to head to Florida. So we're as guilty of bad policy decisions that spread epidemics because of public panic as anybody else.
You talked about India, and the idea that everybody walked home is pretty astonishing when you think of what that might mean with that massive population. But you also talked about Brazil and South Africa, Nigeria, Indonesia. Is the same thing likely to happen there once they get around to ordering everybody to stay home?
Well, it's interesting because both Nigeria and South Africa have taken strong government action, calling on their people to stay in place and not travel and so on. And in South Africa, President Cyril Ramaphosa has taken a very, very strong stand to try and control the epidemic with whatever toolkit he has handy. And then, Lagos, anybody that's ever been in Lagos knows trying to control an outbreak in Lagos is a tough challenge. And the central government of Nigeria is quite weak right now. So it's not clear how much they'll be able to really limit the movement of people and the movement of virus. In South Africa, what worries me obviously is the townships, places like Soweto, Khayelitsha, and so on, where you have incredible density of population living in conditions that are somewhere kind of between what we would consider an American slum and what you see when you look at images of refugee camps. Many people are without running water, without water to wash their hands, when that is the number one thing you want them doing in this particular pandemic. And they're very densely co-housed in very, very small shacks and lean-to houses and so on. And so I just am in dread fear of what will happen if and when this virus hits those communities.
When you say you're in dread fear, I sort of hate to ask you to elaborate on that, but I feel responsible to do it. What do you mean? What's the scenario?
You take a place like Soweto. It's got parts of Soweto that are actually comparative wealthy with big houses and so on, but the vast majority of people in Soweto are living in what by American standards would be considered pretty squalid conditions, and often living with 2, 3, 4 people in a very, very small space, 200 to 300 square feet, without personal running water and personal toilet facilities. And we know that this virus is spread by multiple means, not just the sort of airborne concern of droplet spread from one coughing person to another, but it's also spread by oral fecal route, meaning if you don't wash your hands thoroughly, the virus may be present on your hands either because you've recently used the toilet facilities or you've been in physical contact with a contaminated surface. And if you're unable to get a hold of soap and warm water and thoroughly wash your hands, then your hands are the vector. And anything you touch and anybody you touch is potentially spreading virus. And that, you know, when you think about a township type setting or a refugee setting in outside Syria, in Lebanon, for example, or in Turkey, or the people of Idlib in northern Syria, or the Rohingya people that are in refugee status in Bangladesh from Burma. When you think of places like this, you realize that the average person has almost no options, no ways to protect themselves from contamination. And there's just the list of things they could do to protect themselves is incredibly small. So look at how rapidly here in New York City the virus is spreading. And we have a well-educated, by global standards, well-educated population. Everybody's been hearing over and over and over again, and you can't turn on the TV or radio without hearing it just pummeling you. Wash your hands, cover your mouth when you cough, etc. And yet it is spreading very rapidly in this city right now.
So whether you're talking about India or Brazil or Lagos or South Africa, if there is in fact a difference in wealth, as you indicated, in a lot of those places, not in the refugee camps perhaps, but in other places, it would seem to me that since the virus pays no attention to what your economic status is, it will undoubtedly spread then to everybody, will it not?
I don't think you have to look at South Africa to see a class difference in susceptibility and ask that question. I mean, you could ask it just as well about the west side of Los Angeles or right here in Brooklyn, New York. I mean, I think always there's a class difference in susceptibility to disease just simply because people have less access to ways to protect themselves and less access to healthcare, to testing, to all of that. But look, we're in an epidemic now where through a series of mistakes made by our federal government, nobody has access to testing. Nobody has access to particularly protective equipment. Masks are in short supply, and most of what's available is the wrong kind of mask. They won't really work to protect you. Latex gloves are in short supply. Even nitrile gloves are in short supply. There's, you know, so it doesn't really matter whether you're rich, poor, middle income, what have you. We're all in a boat together. That's a pretty difficult situation. I think the big difference for the rich is that, of course, they can opt out. They can fly off to distant places with very remote populations, as many have, to their, you know, vacation house in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, or their beach house in the Hamptons, and hunker down in great comfort while most of us are on much tighter quarters in much more densely populated areas.
In 1994, you wrote a book called The Coming Plague. Is this it?
Well, it certainly fits all the descriptions of what I was getting at. I think for decades, the belief was in the research community that the next big pandemic would be an influenza, a form of flu, perhaps more deadly than the 1918 flu. But nobody really thought much about coronaviruses because until very recently in history, all coronaviruses were pretty benign to people. You know, about half of all common colds come from coronaviruses. And, you know, you don't worry, you don't go to the hospital because of a common cold. But what we've seen starting in 2003 with SARS, 2002-3, is the emergence of coronaviruses directly from bats through an intermediary animal species to humans in forms that are far more dangerous than a common cold. That would start with SARS, then MERS, and now COVID-19.
Given what you said a moment ago, it seems to me you're illustrating a point that's often been made, which is that the pandemic will expose the failures of a government that hasn't invested sufficiently in the health of all of its constituents. And consequently, everybody will be in one way or another caught up in it, even if they have to remove themselves to a remote location.
All really serious epidemics expose government frailty and expose government error. I think, you know, you think about Ebola outbreaks I've been in, and they, you know, in many cases, they're spreading because there's an absence of government. Government is in anarchy or, frankly, just completely absent, not really doing its job. And certainly when China began cracking down in this epidemic on its own population and locking down whole cities, a lot of the outside world was saying, oh, we wouldn't do that in a democracy. We wouldn't do that in our country. That's just the authoritarian Chinese state reverting immediately to its knee-jerk response. But of course, what we've seen is that there's really only two ways to go. One is the South Korean way, which is all based on testing, testing, and more testing, so that you really know who carries virus and you target your actions to the carriers. Or it's the Italian-Spanish response, which is we reacted too late. We didn't bring testing on board in any kind of methodical, well-thought-out way. So we have no choice but to focus on our hospitals, our morgues, and a huge out-of-control crisis. And unfortunately, here in the United States, our pattern is directly following that of both Spain and Italy.
So what do you predict?
I think we're in for a really tragic, incredibly difficult 2 months in the United States, going out well into July. And it could go even further depending on what actions states take right now and big cities take right now. I think the time to act, the time to take really significant steps has already evaporated for some parts of the country. It's already too late. For other parts of the United States, you still have a moment. So wake up and do what needs to be done. Social distancing is the major tool we have. Nothing else really is available because we don't have massive testing capacity. Maybe we will, but you know, we can't bank on it that a mayor in a city in Mississippi or Arkansas can order up testing of 20,000 people and affordably get access. I don't think so. Not in the near future. and you can probably hear the sirens outside. There's suddenly an increase. This is a steady occurrence here. What we'll see, there's a new study out of University of Washington from the International Health and Evaluation Health Evaluation and Metrics group, and they are predicting that different parts of the country will peak at different times and then see their epidemics taper off to a really controllable number daily emerging, and that New York will be the hardest hit first, that we will peak within the next 10 days. And then we will begin to taper. And by the time we begin to taper, we will have had at least 10,000 dead in New York City. Other parts of the country will come much later. And California is kind of in the middle. You'll probably in California see peaking sometime in mid to late April. And some parts of the country really won't peak until late May, even June. There are other models. That's not the only one. But that is the model that ended up persuading President Trump not to aim for Easter as his date to reopen the country, so to speak, because it predicts even if you do everything right, we're going to lose 80,000 Americans over the next 3 months. And if you don't do everything right, the death toll could be as many as 250,000.
And ultimately, of course, what we have to hope for is a vaccine, but it sounds like it's going to be a long time between now and then. Again, Lori Garrett is at what is currently the epicenter of the epicenter of the epicenter of the epicenter worldwide. Thank you, as always.
All the best, Warren. Take care of yourself.
Well, Lori Garrett has got it right, and of course, we all do want to take care of ourselves, especially after what seems like an unending stream of bad news. And there's nothing that helps to endure a crisis better than music. The coronavirus pandemic is now the subject of a lot of new songs. They're all over the world. And we're going to give you a taste, starting with the coronavirus blues.
You know, the shell's all empty, and my cupboard is bare. Fighting in the aisle, it's dystopian out there. Lord, 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 what's a poor man to do? Stuck home alone with just my ball. I got no coronavirus blues.
Chance you get you blowing up my phone. All this pressure, you know I've been in my zone. Yeah, yeah. If you ain't about the paper, why you talking? Why you talking? Couple racks inside the tape, bitch, I white walk. I'm in quarantine, bitch, please leave me alone. I'm in quarantine, bitch, please leave me alone. I'm in quarantine, bitch, please leave me alone.
El pinche coronavirus a todos sacó de quicio. La gente anda paniqueada, ya nadie hace caso omiso. Como ya le dio a Tom Hanks, pues creen que ya valió Wilson.
Protection. If we don't stop it, evil.
producer of today's podcast is Andrea Brody, our engineer Chuck Prebatary. You can find other episodes. They're always available on your favorite podcasting app. We are at tothepoint_KCRW. You can tweet me at WarrenAlney1. As I've been saying for a couple of weeks, we will not let social distancing prevent us from podcasting. We will be back as usual. So stay healthy, stay informed. Thanks for being with us this time, and join us again.